On Tech News Today, Yahoo joins Google in the easy encryption of email. Plus, we clear up the controversy over Facebook's Messenger app, the confusion around Russia's Wi-Fi edict. We'll even tell you how to weaponize your cat. All that and more coming up right now on Tech News Today.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for Tech News Today is provided by CashFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Tech News Today for Friday, August 8th, 2014. This episode is brought to you by ZipRecruiter. ZipRecruiter makes hiring faster, easier, and cheaper. Post your job to 50-plus job boards with one click. Try ZipRecruiter with a free 4-day trial now at ZipRecruiter.com/TNT. That's ZipRecruiter.com/TNT. And by Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that makes it fast and easy to create your own professional website or online portfolio. For a free 2-week trial and 10% off, go to squarespace.com and use the offer code TNT. Tech News Today is the show where we talk about the tech news with the journalists who report it. Welcome to the show. I'm Mike Elgin. Brian Burnett is TriCasting, the TriCast Master today. Thank you so much for doing that, Brian. And his brother is over here, like, sort of guiding the teleprompting situation here. We've got a whole crew over here doing the teleprompter. It's a big job. It takes at least two people to do it. And our guest co-anchor today is Lee Hutchinson, who is the senior reviews editor for Ars Technica. Welcome to you, Lee Hutchinson.
Thanks a lot, Mike.
So as the senior reviews editor, what is your day like, generally speaking? Like, what do you do?
Well, so I get up and I drink, and I oversee the product news and
sounds
reviews.
Sounds like a news editor.
Ars Technica. Yeah. I've got a crew of guys who write for me, and we do product reviews and look at gadgets and all kinds of stuff. I also fill in for the general news flow. In fact, a story of mine just hit the front page like literally 30 seconds ago. So, yeah, it's a busy day.
And what was that story about?
It's kind of a geek story. It's a Good Friday story. Babylon 5 series creator J. Michael Straczynski announced that he's going to start working on a reboot script for the Babylon 5 TV series. He wants to do it as a movie and reboot it with new actors and potentially a new plot and all kinds of cool stuff. The news came out at Comic-Con last week, and I'm a big Babylon 5 guy. You can't see it, but I've got a huge B5 poster right here. So it's good news for me.
You heard it here first, folks. And Lee Hutchinson is also the senior movie reviews editor at Ars Technica. So we always talk about trends and on this show. And Lee, of course, you are always writing about trends. And a lot of these trends are creeping. They sort of gradually become a new way of doing things or a new socially accepted way to do things with technology. Well, every once in a while, you have to sort of stop and mark a line in the sand that's been crossed. And today, I think we crossed one. I think it's clear now that tweets are the official way to announce even the most important things. This morning at 8:44 a.m. Eastern Time, the Pentagon Press Secretary Rear Admiral John Kirby sent out a tweet announcing that the United States had launched airstrikes in Iraq. Now, yesterday, President Obama said that we were reserving the right to launch such airstrikes under certain conditions. And today, Admiral Kirby sent out this tweet. Now, this wasn't a follow-up tweet to a press conference or a press announcement or something that happened on TV. This tweet was the announcement. It's really kind of interesting. And I think, Wall Street Journal had a nice piece on this. But it's just this is the way that things are announced now. And I think it can't get any more official than this, with the Pentagon actually using Twitter to announce this.
No, it's fascinating because Twitter brings, I mean, as a journalist, it's hugely important. I use Twitter continually. I probably throw up 100 tweets a day, and it's outstanding for keeping immediately in touch with sources. And for something like this, where it's, you know, the admiral, I saw he had a verified Twitter account and is able to launch news out very, very quickly. It provides an immediacy that even publication on a website doesn't have.
Yeah, it's really quite an important thing for journalists, as you said. It's important for journalists to promote their stuff, to have conversations and so on. You know, Facebook is important. Google Plus is important to a certain extent for certain types of things, but nothing trumps Twitter for really real-time news. So that was an interesting development, I thought. And I saw it like 5 minutes after he tweeted it. And I saw it through retweets by people who had been following him. I wasn't following him. And so that news spread very, very quickly thanks to Twitter. Well, let's jump into the news. Yahoo announced today that the company would soon use PGP encryption to make the Yahoo email service secure. Forbes writer and reporter Kashmir Hill says Yahoo will use a modified version of the Chrome plugin that Google uses, or at least the technology in that. And Google's technology is called End-to-End. Now, Lee, you wrote a piece about this for Ars Technica. What do you make of this? Is this going to be a good idea for Yahoo, or are they going to confuse users?
No, I think it's a good idea. More encryption is always better, I think. The difficulty is with Stamos from Yahoo acknowledged this. This is Yahoo's chief information security officer, acknowledged when he made the announcement that one of the more complicated parts with deploying encryption like this isn't necessarily the actual deployment. It's user education. It's making sure that people understand what is and isn't kept secure with technologies like PGP. So if you wrap your email in PGP encryption, for example, the content may be much more proof against being snooped on, but it's still relatively easy to tell from an outside observer's point where the email is from and where the email is going. So the example given by Stamos is an outside observer may not be able to tell what you're emailing your priest, but it's still still obvious that you are emailing your priest, for example.
Right, exactly. And of course, as Edward Snowden and others have said, that the ultimate outcome is when no user education is required and everything is absolutely secure. This is an interim step toward some hopeful future where all communications is completely secured, including the destination of email communication. Now, Yahoo's Chief Information Officer Alex Stamos announced this at Black Hat, of all places, but the news was also tweeted by Yan Zhu, who's a former EFF engineer but currently is at Yahoo working on this project. Now, Lee, before we move on from this story, can you tell us a little bit about end-to-end? I don't think a lot of people are fully aware of what this is and how it works and how long it's been around and all that kind of stuff.
Sure. It's a plugin for Chrome, and it's an alpha quality plugin. So, it's not something that you would deploy to, in production to a large organization, but it enables. So when you do PGP encryption, if you've ever dabbled with it at all, it's not necessarily an easy process or one that's very transparent. It requires quite a bit of understanding in key management, and you need extra tools. And, just encrypting your email and then decrypting an email isn't necessarily the easiest thing. And so with this end-to-end browser plugin, and there are other plugins as well, companies like Google and now Yahoo are trying to simplify that. They're trying to make it easy to wrap your email in encryption without compromising the security of that encryption, but flatten the curve, the learning curve that you have to climb in order to do it effectively. Now, one thing that I'm seeing as this write-up is getting echoed out across other news sites is I'm seeing this talked about as being something like it's going to spy-proof your email, or it's going to totally secure your email. The name of the plugin, end-to-end, makes it sound like this might be something where it really is end-to-end security, and it's NSA-proofing your email or whatever. And that's just not true. It's got to be emphasized whenever you talk about encryption like this that this is not snoop-proofing your email. This will make it more difficult to intercept and read your email, but let's be totally honest here. If the NSA or the FBI or a state-sponsored agency or a sufficiently motivated attacker wants to read your emails, they're going to do it. There are plenty of other ways they can do it, including what's jokingly referred to, you may have heard this, as rubber hose cryptography. That's the, rather than try to decrypt your email, just tie you to a chair and whack your knees with a rubber hose until you give up the password.
The old-fashioned ways tend to work.
That's right. The old-fashioned ways. And what it all comes down to is stuff like this shrinks what information security professionals call your attack surface. It makes you less vulnerable. And there's an old saying that if you ever find yourself standing next to a hobbit facing down a hungry dragon, you don't have to outrun the dragon. You just have to outrun the hobbit. This is all about making yourself less vulnerable than the next guy so that it's less convenient to get to your stuff than it is to just move on and attack someone else.
Well, that's a terrible message for hobbits, but for the rest of us, that's good advice. Now, one of the interesting things about all this, now, you just to be clear about what we're talking about, this Yahoo's technology that they're working on and Google's Chrome plugin don't do anything about metadata. The metadata is still available. And, of course, metadata is the big excuse that the NSA said, hey, we're just collecting metadata. No, metadata is the best kind of data. If you're going after terrorists and drug smugglers, whoever it is you're going after, they're going to be cryptic in what they say on email. But the metadata is far more valuable because it can be you can look for patterns and all that kind of stuff. And I like to remind people that it was really nicely illustrated in the movie Zero Dark Thirty, where they actually found bin Laden because simply the thread of information that led them to bin Laden was that a courier called his mother in a pattern that was kind of erratic. It was suspicious the times of days and the locations from which the metadata for those phone calls was what led the Navy SEALs to bin Laden ultimately. And it wasn't the content of email. It was just who was calling whom and when and from where. That was all it took. And so, as you say, that doesn't mean your email is secure, that you're going to have this kind of stuff. It's also another interesting trivia point, speaking of the sort of war on terror or the whole NSA situation. The revelations by Edward Snowden, which came through Glenn Greenwald, were delayed by several months because when Snowden first contacted Greenwald, he said, I have all these crazy things I want to tell you, but first you have to install PGP. And Greenwald's like, I'm not going to install PGP. That looks super complicated. I'm just not going to do it. And several months went by before someone else told him, you really have to install this stuff and contact and talk to this guy because he's got some crazy stuff to tell you. And so that's another example of how the user unfriendliness historically of PGP has caused a major change in how and when we receive really important news and information simply because there was a journalist, a very smart person, fairly security savvy and pretty paranoid actually, who couldn't wrap his head around the task of using PGP. And that's the problem right there. It's got to be much more user-friendly.
It's difficult. It's not impossible. Of course, people use it, but it's hard to set up. And more importantly, it's hard to set up right and properly, securely. And it's easy to fall. It's easy to set up. It's easy to generate, a public and private key. And, you give your public key out to people and you don't properly verify that the public keys you're receiving from them are the right ones. I mean, it's easy. It takes a lot of verification and there are a lot of steps to doing it, not just setting it up, but setting it up properly. And that's the catch. And that's what browser plugins and automated key exchange and storage, like the kind of thing that Google and Yahoo are doing, that's what they're trying to simplify. It's that not just doing it, but doing it right.
Yeah. Well, it was an interesting story, and I'm glad Yahoo's doing something.
Absolutely.
So in just a sec, we're going to clear up some confusion that's happening around Facebook Messenger. But first, I want to tell you about ZipRecruiter, one of our sponsors today. ZipRecruiter will help you hire the right people and do it fast. And that's super important because you're in a race for time with other people who want to hire the right people also. And so you want to get to those best candidates very fast and sort through the candidates, figure out who's the best candidate, interview them, hire them fast. If you're a hiring manager or own a small business, you got to use ZipRecruiter. They will enable you to post your job to 50-plus job sites all at once. These job sites include LinkedIn, Twitter, Craigslist, Google+, Facebook, you name it, all the job-related sites, Job Unlocker, sites you never even heard of. You don't even have to hear about them because ZipRecruiter knows all about them, and you never know where that best candidate is going to come from. The problem is with casting such a wide net, though, is you're going to get all kinds of people back who aren't qualified, and ZipRecruiter will help you with that problem as well. They'll simply go through and identify who are the most qualified candidates according to your criteria, and then you can go through just the qualified candidates very, very quickly. And you can find candidates in any city, in any industry, nationwide. You just post it once, and you watch your qualified candidates roll in to ZipRecruiter's easy-to-use interface. It's very important that it's easy to use because it's easy to use. You will use it, and you will hire the best people, and your company will succeed because you've got such great people. That's the whole point of ZipRecruiter, and they're going to help you succeed in your career and your business. ZipRecruiter has been used by more than 200,000 businesses. Our listeners right now can try ZipRecruiter for a free 4-day trial. Go to ZipRecruiter.com/TNT. That's ZipRecruiter.com /TNT. TNT, of course, is for Tech News Today. And we thank ZipRecruiter for their support of Tech News Today. Facebook has now separated its Messenger app from the main Facebook app. It's official. This separation is complete. In order to use Messenger on a phone, you now have to download and install Facebook's separate Messenger app. But the move by Facebook and the online chatter surrounding it has caused panic and confusion among some users. Reid Albergati wrote a really nice piece today on the Wall Street Journal website clarifying the situation, and he joins us now. Welcome, Reid.
Thanks for having me.
Now, the blogs are freaking out over fears that Facebook's Messenger app will, quote, call phone numbers without your intervention or, quote, use the camera at any time without your permission. Where did they get this idea?
Well, it all comes from really a December article in the Huffington Post that listed, it says verbatim, the privacy policies for this Facebook Messenger app. Now, what it doesn't say is that it was actually only for Android. The privacy, or really actually, I shouldn't say privacy policy, it's really the permissions for Android's version of Facebook Messenger and the iOS version of Facebook Messenger are very, very different. And that's because this difference of philosophy between Google and Apple on how it handles these. With Android, when you download an app, you have to agree to the entire list of potential uses for that app. Whereas on iOS apps, you agree as you go. So for instance, Facebook Messenger has a voice calling feature. If you never use that, then you never have to agree to give it permission to use your microphone. Now, the other thing is Google doesn't let companies write their own permissions. So Facebook has to just use these generic permissions that Google writes and then apply them to their app. And until before June, you know, Google had these long and complicated permissions that included a lot of things that are now not included in the permissions. If you go on and you read what's there now, it looks very different than what was listed in this Huffington Post article in December. So there's misinformation about this. Now, that's not to say by using this app, you're not giving up certain, you know, making certain privacy compromises, but they're not as great compared to what you give up when you just use Facebook's app, as some people are saying.
So, Reid, this is Lee. This is interesting because it seems like this is a problem that this is not only Facebook that's fallen into this trap. Like, if you'll remember, you may or may not recall about a year ago when Jay-Z released his Magna Carta Holy Grail album, there was a companion app for that, that it was like the same thing. It was like the developers had checked every single box in the permissions the app wants. I mean, the app was supposed to just let you look at, lyrics and stuff before it came out like a couple of days before the album was released. But it ended up like it wanted to look at your contacts. It wanted to be able to send and receive calls and send and receive tweets on your behalf. There was like all of the permissions were checked. I mean, is this just like a common oversight that companies can make when they're designing applications?
Yeah, I think it's an issue with Android. I mean, I talked with Facebook about this and they said, look, it's really frustrating actually for us because, you know, we can't just write the exact permissions that we need for the app. We have to go by what Google writes. And now Google has actually improved this, it seems, since the Jay-Z app came out, really in the last couple of months. So I think it's not as much of a problem as it is today. But, you know, as a user, it's really nice to be able to, you know, decline permissions for certain things and accept them for others based on your comfort level. You can do that on the iOS with the iOS permissions system. You cannot do that with Androids. So, you know, I think it's an interesting topic that I really wasn't much aware of before I started looking into this Messenger app.
Well, the idea that Apple is more flexible than Google and Android is something you don't hear a whole lot. What are some of the other differences, do you think, between developing for iOS and Android that sort of have a disadvantage for Android? I mean, this is basically making Android versions of apps kind of look bad, freaking people out unnecessarily. Are there other gotchas like this in there somewhere?
Well, I mean, I think the other point is that you have to agree to these permissions up front before ever even using the app. Yeah. So you sit there and you look at, you know, all the potential things that this app might do in the future on Android. And you have to, you know, check, I agree. And, you know, that's a scary thing, especially when you're, you know, let's say you're a heavy Facebook user and you want to send a Facebook message through your app. And now you're being forced to actually download the Facebook app and use that, the Facebook Messenger app, rather. So, you know, it's a, I think you, there's a feeling of you're with Android users that you're sort of being locked into stuff, whereas on Apple, you can kind of decide as you go. So, you know, that's the other point I would make.
Now, Reed, you track Facebook closer than any journalist that I know. What's your take on why Facebook has decided to force users to use the Messenger app? I mean, before, there was a Messenger app, and you could use it if you wanted to, but you could also use the main Facebook app to send messages. Why did they spin it out of the main Facebook app? Why are they forcing this change?
Well, first I'll say, you know, the Facebook line here would be they wanted to give users a better experience. They think that sending messages with a separate app is just better. And I would say, you know, I've used the app, and I've also used the messaging system within Facebook. I like them both. I think that the Messenger app is a little bit of a better experience. But then I would say, you know, another really important thing here to note is that Facebook is getting heavily into messages. You might recall a little acquisition they made for $19 billion, a company called WhatsApp with 500 million users around the world. Facebook believes that messaging is really kind of the future of social media. And within these Messenger apps, you know, there are lots of things they can do. They can create, you know, voice calls. You know, it could be a replacement for a phone, essentially. And they can also create payment systems. And I think, you know, you saw a big hire from eBay, you know, from the PayPal division come over to Facebook. So I think we could see a whole list of services incorporated into the Messenger app, you know, in the next months, years. And Facebook wants people to use it. They want them to get used to this so they can start rolling out these features.
As you said, you can now make phone calls with WhatsApp. And I think Facebook should use that to call Google and say, hey, fix the permission situation on your app, because that's really kind of terrible and makes you look bad. So
before we leave this, Mike, just real quick, I wanted to emphasize that there are so Android's flexibility works for and against it. But in this particular case, with Android, at least, there are other apps. There's apps on top of apps that you can download to manage app permissions post-install. So you do have to agree to the long list of permissions going in, but there are ways to manage them and to audit applications like this one once it gets installed to see what it's doing. So you're not totally just thrown to the wolves with this. There are ways to manage exposure, but still, you know, that default list is scary.
It's a good point.
Reed Albergati writes at WSJ.com, and you can follow him on Twitter, and you should follow him on Twitter at Reed Albergati. That's his last name is spelled A-L-B-E-R-G-O-T-T-I. Thank you so much for joining us again, Reed Albergati.
Thank you, Reed.
Thanks. It's always fun to be here. Thanks, guys.
All right. Glad you enjoy it. We enjoy you having you on. Well, Russian Wi-Fi users are outraged and confused about a muddled new decree forcing people to show a passport or other ID before using Wi-Fi hotspots in the country. Russian media first reported that Prime Minister Dmitry Medvedev signed an order requiring proof of identity before using any public Wi-Fi. Then the Russian Communications Ministry clarified that the rule only applies to hotspots set up by network operators. And then a Moscow city official announced that it only applies to Wi-Fi at Russian post offices. Media outlets, including Izvestia, added to the confusion by reporting that all operators of all public hotspots are now required to record the hardware identifiers for devices that are logging on, along with the user's full names and ID or driver's license numbers, and they'll need to keep this information for 6 months and submit it to the authorities when required. And operators themselves will need to register with Russia's telecom regulator as a personal data operator. At this point,
it just sounds like a total mess.
It's a total mess. At this point, the only thing that's clear is that there's some kind of crackdown, but nobody agrees on the details. But clearly, there's a crackdown of something's being restricted here. Something's being demanded of Wi-Fi users, and it's just really not clear. And Lee, this is another kind of blunder in the whole kind of war of words, the public perception war between the Russian government and kind of the West or the United States. And in fact, this was implemented specifically to counter what they consider propaganda by the United States. The other blunder that I'm referring to, Lee, is that in response to U.S. Economic sanctions, Russia announced that they would be banning certain types of food imports. And so the Russian public is finally saying, hey, wait a minute. This is terrible. This is going to raise prices. We don't like any of this stuff. So it's the second big blunder in all of this that's really hitting the Russian government. But, you know, Lee, what do you think about this whole concept of just asking a public to use their identification to use Wi-Fi?
It feels like a throwback to the old Soviet days. This, papers, please. Papers, please.
That's right, exactly. If they had Wi-Fi back then, they would have done this.
That's right. This is really interesting because, you know, we are, the United States and the Western world in general is a huge, almost inadvertent cultural exporter. You know, I was reading on the article that you're citing here and a couple of other places that one of the potential goals here might be to leading up to like a block of Facebook and other big, you know, popular Facebook and Twitter and other services like that. These are the kinds of things. It's almost like the internet equivalent of McDonald's. They sort of leak out and dribble all over the entire rest of the world, regardless of whether it's an intentional thing or not. It's fascinating to watch the attempts to control. I don't know how far this is going to go. You know, I've never been to Russia, and I don't know how exactly they plan on enforcing this. There just seem to be so many practical issues around actually doing this, at least in the way that it's being described.
Exactly. The cost of this policy is massive to the Russian government, and the benefit to the Russian government is minuscule or non-existent. And I think another thing that you referenced without being too specific was the Turkey situation, where the Turkish government was trying to suppress information about an alleged audio recording or a video, I don't recall whether it's audio or video, of somebody within the inner circle of the government taking bribes and so on. And to suppress that, they banned Twitter and they banned YouTube and did all this kind of stuff. And the news that they were banning it brought the news of this bribe to the world.
Yeah, no, it's incredibly difficult to, at least today, with easy access to VPNs and to all kinds of workaround methods, unless you are China-style dedicated to blocking internet access, or North Korea-style dedicated to blocking internet access to your citizenry, it's just impractical to do. And even trying to put boundaries around it like this and attaching, you know, names and addresses and hardware IDs and stuff to each access attempt, it's just so much to do, and it's so impractical. It just seems like there would be better ways if they wanted to do that, you know.
It's getting tough out there for a wannabe dictator, I'll tell you that. It's not like it used to be.
No, not at all. Stupid information wanting to be free.
That's right. Darn information. Well, some 900 or so book authors plan to publish an open letter in the New York Times Sunday, slamming Amazon for their negotiating tactics with publishing giant Hachette. The letter will ask Times readers to send email to the personal email address of Amazon CEO Jeff Bezos, and his email address will be published in the letter. The cost of the ad is more than $100,000. Speaking of information wanting to be free, these authors don't want books to be free. They don't want books to be cheap, and they don't want Amazon to single out specific authors to squeeze the publisher. That's really the main beef here. They're not so much taking sides in the negotiation. They're slamming Amazon for the tactic of essentially holding books hostage, of delaying the shipments of books, and creating all kinds of FUD around specific authors and specific books in order to pressure Hachette into giving up and acceding to Amazon's demands.
Right. You know, and Amazon has developed, I mean, they've got the dominant electronic book distribution ecosystem. You know, everybody's got a Kindle, everybody reads their ebooks on their Kindle. And so, you know, the question here is, what should Amazon's role necessarily be in defining the prices that get applied to the ebooks that it sells? I mean, what is you know, Amazon obviously has, being a publicly traded company, they've got their own obligations to their shareholders to return value and, you know, blah, 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 all that stuff. But what, like, properly, what role should they be taking here? What's out of bounds and what's within bounds? You know, where should they be able to exert, their pressure on pricing? And clearly the authors here feel that whatever Amazon does want to do, they're not agreeing with it.
And as we pointed out on the show before, the word here that isn't used enough when applied to Amazon is the word monopsony. A monopsony, well, let's start with what a monopoly is. A monopoly is when you have a dominant share of selling. A monopsony is when you have a dominant share of buying, and that's what Amazon does. Amazon has a lot of control over what gets published because they're the ones who are buying books from publishers. They have so much dominance in that space. You pretty much have to be on Amazon if you want to publish to the mass market. And so they have a monopoly for buying, a monopsony. And they use that to bring down prices, to force down prices. And this is really squeezing traditional publishers who have an entirely different model. And it's muddled and kind of made a little bit more sinister by the fact that Amazon is happy to provide a complete alternative to the entire publishing industry, the entire publishing system. Just go to the website, fill out their forms, and you can start, you know, you can hire Amazon people to edit your ebook. You can hire Amazon people to design your ebook. You can hire Amazon people to do all this stuff. And so it's a little unnerving, especially since I think you would agree, Lee, that the future of books is electronic. I mean, I think paper books will always be with us, but they'll be a sort of an expensive thing for the wealthy eventually. E-books are the future, and their market share of e-books and their monopsony over e-book, and of course, this is all about e-books, is a little bit scary. And so, you know, these authors are stepping forward and sort of trying to make their voice heard. Now, the letter was written by the thriller author Douglas Preston, who happens to write for Hachette. It's probably a very well-written letter. He's a great writer. And he's asking Amazon to stop, quote, hurting authors as part of the negotiations. So quite an interesting turn of events. I can't wait to see the ad in the Sunday New York Times.
You know, in a lot of ways, the internet, as it's done with so many things, has democratized publishing, but it hasn't done it nearly to the same degree as it has, print publishing. It hasn't done it nearly as much as it has, say, you know, music production or video production. You would think that it would be relatively easy to go in and write, write a novel, write a book, whatever, and then self-publish it. But because the preferred distribution mechanism is, you know, it really is Kindles. That's the way to get your book out on the internet and to get people to see it. And it adds cachet and legitimacy. It adds a lot more legitimacy than if, you know, you write a book and publish it on a website. And it also gives you, Amazon handles the revenue gathering and all of this. It gives you this big package that you can use. And it's that distribution control that everyone wants to buy into. And that, I think, is the crux of this. It's not so much that I can't just go and publish a book myself. It's that if I want to publish a book myself in a way that people are going to read and in a way that's going to, you know, allow me as an author to make money and to make a living, this is kind of the route you have to take for it.
Absolutely is. And of course, it has to be said that Amazon's view on all this is that they're looking out for the reader and the book buyer by bringing down prices, forcing efficiency on an inefficient industry. And it's all for the benefit of literacy and for the consumer. So that would be their point of view. Well, in just a minute, we're going to talk to you about what's happening with those banned Apple products in China. But first, I want to tell you about Squarespace, our other sponsor for this show. Squarespace will help you build the most beautiful website you have ever seen, and it can be all yours. If you want to express yourself, if you want to forward your career, if you want to start a blog, you want to sell something online, you're going to need a website. And if you have an ugly website or a poorly performing website, well, it's not going to go so well. You want a beautiful website, and Squarespace is the place to build one. They have 25 beautiful templates for you to choose from. And to get started, no matter what type of website you want to create, there's a template to match. And these are responsive templates that automatically redesign themselves on the fly for mobile devices or whatever sort of device the person is seeing it with. And they also have something called a logo creator tool. So it's not just a website, but you can also build a beautiful logo with no design experience, no design skill at all. And you can check that out at blog.squarespace.com. There's a video in there to show you how this amazing tool works. And if you're a blogger and you want to switch to Squarespace, it's a great idea, and it's easy to do because you can move your existing blog and just import the content from WordPress, Blogger, Tumblr, and other major blogging platforms. You know, you can use your own domain name, all of it. You can have a fully professional, beautifully performing blog, and it's really, really easy to do. You want to sell something or raise money for your nonprofit? All subscription plan levels now support e-commerce on Squarespace. Squarespace starts at just $8 a month, and that includes a free domain name if you sign up for a year. And of course, it's really, really mobile friendly. As I said, the websites look great on mobile devices, and you can manage them with Squarespace's apps for iPhone and iPad. Very, very powerful stuff. So start your free 2-week trial. No credit card required. Start building your website today. And when you decide to sign up for Squarespace, just use the offer code TNT. That'll take 10% off the price. We thank Squarespace for their support of Tech News Today, and I personally recommend it and have been a happy customer for a long time. I love Squarespace. Great site. Well, in a follow-up, we told you this week that Apple products had been banned for purchase by the Chinese government as part of a wider crackdown on American technology products in the country. But now, China's central government procurement center is saying that Apple's absence on the list of approved products is not a ban. It just reflects the fact that Apple never applied to be in the list in the first place. And they said, in any event, the list was not a total list of allowable products to be purchased by Chinese government agencies, but merely the list of energy-saving products that are recommended. And in other news today, today's the day, people. It's World Cat Day. That's right. So say hi to your furry friend. It's fitting, therefore, that a security researcher named Gene Bransfield will hold a talk at the DEF CON Security Conference in Las Vegas this weekend called How to Weaponize Your Pets. I'll let that sink in for a second. In the presentation, he'll explain how he built a cat collar containing a custom coded firmware, a Wi-Fi card, a GPS module, and a battery. In one test, a kitty named Coco, belonging to Bransfield's wife's grandmother, roamed around in the neighborhood mapping Wi-Fi hotspots and probing for easily hackable networks. His invention is...
I used to have a kitty named Coco, a Siamese kitty named Coco. Looked exactly like the one in that picture.
Well, you know, it's a great name and it's a great cat, and this sounds like a great collar. The invention, Lee, is actually called the War Kitty collar.
War Kitty.
War Kitty. Remember
like,
war driving?
Like war driving, yeah.
Exactly, but with a cat. More
well, look at him. Look at him fuzzy. Spin.
Look at him go. That is amazing. The best news is that the War Kitty collar costs less than $100 to build, and he's going to teach everybody how to build one. So weaponize your cat. This is the best reason to get a cat I've ever heard of.
So this is great. So he's actually tracking the cat's movements around the neighborhood. So you get to see where your cat goes anyway, which might be illuminating in and of itself. And then you also get to gather your neighbor's Wi-Fi SSIDs as you go.
This is kind of what Google's Street View cars did, which gives me another idea, which is like, why not strap a camera to these cats and, you know, have a sort of a cat view sort of mapping system of the whole neighborhood? Why not?
I would watch that movie.
They're wandering around anyway.
That's right.
Well, that's the tech news today. Our TNT fan of the day is Rose Sterling in Brooklyn, New York, who posted this selfie. There it is. She posted it on Twitter and tweeted that Tech News Today is part of her morning makeup routine. She listens on her iPhone, but apparently takes pictures with her Android phone. That's our kind of listener. Check it out. Looking good, Rose, and we'll take all the credit for that awesome makeup job.
There you go. Thank you, Rose.
So, you know, how do you watch or listen to TNT? Just take a picture of your setup and post it on Google+, Twitter, or Facebook using the hashtag #HowDoYouWatchTNT, and we will find it and maybe even highlight it on the show. Lee Hutchinson, thank you so much for joining us as our guest co-anchor today.
Thank you, Mike. Had a great time.
Tell us where people can read your work.
ArsTechnica.com, ArsTechnica.com. And I'm also on Twitter as Lee_Ars.
Wonderful. Everybody follow Lee. Great stuff. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
All right. Well, you can subscribe to Tech News Today on Stitcher, iTunes, YouTube, Feedly, Yahoo, RSS. So many options. Choose your favorite at twit.tv/TNT. And please follow us on Twitter, Tech News Today TV. Send us your thoughts and opinions to tnt@twit.tv via email or leave a voicemail at 260-TNT-SHOW. And don't miss our evening newscast, Tech News Tonight, at 4 p.m. Pacific tonight and every weeknight right here on the Twit Network. My name's Mike Elgin. Thanks for tuning in. We'll see you Monday. That box is too small.
I'm never sure when to bring in the music for that at the end.
You know what they say, if I fits, I sits.
That's right.